Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Governor Tony Evers issues a second statewide face mask order to fight surges in COVID-19, but a judge will soon be asked to block that order. A federal judge gives election clerks until November 9 to count the flood of absentee ballots for president, but Republican leaders appeal that six-day extension. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issues a state Senate chamber warning that China's Communist Party is trying to influence groups, including school PTAs. Rewind, your week in review for September 25.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
A lot of news this week, so J.R., let's start with the governor's decision. He faced a Monday deadline to let lapse or extend the statewide mask order. And let's just walk through what he did and some of the reaction before I give you a chance to respond. He declared a new public health emergency requiring masks indoors and enclosed areas until November 21. He acted after reports that six Wisconsin cities with UW campuses were on the list of U.S. cities with the fastest growing COVID-19 diagnoses. His Secretary of Health and Health Services, we worry about the effect students return from an area with a high infection rate could have on their home communities. The governor said Wisconsin's 18 to 24-year-olds have a case rate five. That's five times higher than any other age group. There was a pending lawsuit in Polk County against the first face mask order, which we'll get to in a minute. Now, quickly, let's talk about the response. First of all, what did Governor Evers say? We are facing a new and dangerous phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. Young people especially, please stay home as much as you are able. Skip heading to the bars and wear a mask whenever you go out. We need your help. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, Governor Evers' order is moot, illegal, invalid, and almost assuredly headed for litigation. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, there is already a court challenge referring to the Polk County lawsuit, and undoubtedly there will be more. No one branch of government can rule outside the letter of the law and go unchecked, even during a pandemic. And I'm curious, JR, your response to the statements from Senator Strobel and Noss, but let me just read Senator Noss's. Voss and Fitzgerald must immediately call the legislature back into session to pass a joint resolution ending Governor Evers' new illegal and unnecessary emergency declaration. The legislature is empowered to end any emergency declaration issued by a governor through the simple passage of a joint resolution. We'll talk about Mr. Essenberg's reaction later. Okay, JR, thanks for giving me a chance to give the overview. Talk to me about your perspective on this.
What I heard from people this week, there's one thing that they didn't hear from Robin Voss or Scott Fitzgerald, and that is a pledge to come back and vote on a joint resolution to overturn the mandate, well, the public health emergency and the mandate. Particularly notable with Fitzgerald, remember the last time the governor issued this mask mandate, Fitzgerald said he has the votes to overturn it and wanted to come in. This time, nothing. And what I got from talking to people this week was the dynamic has not changed from what was happening a month ago. And that is that the mask mandate is politically popular. And Republican leadership knows if it comes in to vote on a resolution to overturn it, it'll hurt some members in vulnerable districts. What's more, for Fitzgerald, whereas before he was all ready to go to come in and overturn it, it makes no sense to have leadership divided on that issue and have Fitz saying, let's come in, and Voss silent on that. It puts Robin Voss in a bad position. Look, Governor Evers, this may be the most politically smart thing he's done in the 2 years he's been in office, people tell me. He's put Republican lawmakers in a box because you have, on the one side, a base that wants to get rid of the mask mandate that is chafing about it, but you have, on the other side, a very popular order that goes both for Democrats and moderate voters, even some Republicans who like it. So the lawmakers were vulnerable. Republicans were vulnerable this fall in suburban areas. They would be squeezed by this vote. It's a difficult spot to be in, and they're relying now on a court action to kind of bail them out on this one.
Okay, but as I interview candidates for the ledge, and I've interviewed several dozen, maybe more than 100, you have this regional disparity. When I talk to people north of Highway 10, when I talk to candidates north of Highway 10 and up north, it's not the mask ordinance is not being the mask edict is not being followed. They don't support it, with the exceptions of, I talked yesterday to Democratic Senator Patty Schachner, one of the key takeover goals of Republicans. She said, I support it. My husband's a cancer survivor. So you still have this regional disparity, JR, right?
Oh, absolutely. And remember, it's not being enforced in some places. Like, it's a different world being in Madison versus being in Boston. And not to pick on either of those two cities, but there's just a different level of compliance with the order, and there's not enforcement going on out in a lot of places. Remember, when Evers issued the first order, there were a number of sheriffs, a majority of sheriffs in Wisconsin, they would not enforce this. So you're not seeing it required in a lot of places. And yeah, regional disparity. But again, think about the races. Where are the races that are going to matter this fall? Largely in suburban areas around Milwaukee, one up around the Green Bay area. That's places where folks are like, we're in a bad spot with this when it comes to a vote to overturn it. Again, the base, though, Republican base, really, really hates this thing and really wants it to go away. So they're getting squeezed on it.
Okay, and now I want to go back to the statement by Rick Essenberg, who's president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, who I interviewed yesterday. His first statement, Governor Evers and his team believe the presence of COVID-19 supersedes the rule of law and our state constitution. They are wrong. Letting this gross abuse of power stand is not an option. So when I interviewed Rick Essenberg yesterday, it was a very interesting interview. I suggest you go to wisside.org and look it up. Here's what he said. I said, next steps. He expects Will, his organization, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, to seek an injunction in Polk County very soon. But he also said any other Wisconsin resident or group could file an OA, that's legalese, for original action, asking the Supreme Court to directly take this challenge to the second mask order. Any other PSs, JR, before we move on?
Remember, the original goal of that lawsuit was not to overturn the original mask mandate. It was to have a case developed in the Circuit Court, the Appeals Court, and the Supreme Court about the principles involved, about the powers of the governor in a public health emergency. This extended order changes the ballgame. Because now you have an order that was extended another 60 days. Without Will acting, the governor can keep doing this in perpetuity and keep the requirement in place. So that now raises the question, if and when they're going to file that request for a temporary injunction to prevent the enforcement. Other thing to remember is this. If Republicans come in and overturn Evers' order, guess what he would probably do? Issue a new one. And you can get in a cat and mouse game for the next couple of months between Republicans and the governor about this, which would make Republicans look that much more obsessed with an issue that is popular with voters. That's another reason why I think they're holding off from coming to vote in this thing.
Okay. We got so much news, we got to move on. A federal judge, Robert Conley, added 6 days to the period to count absentee ballots. Now, before his ruling, 8 p.m. on Election Day, November 3rd, was the deadline to count absentee ballots. As I said, he added 6 days to that. The ballots must be postmarked, mailed by November 3. JR, earlier this week, you reported 1.1 million voters had asked for absentee ballots. I know you well enough to know you've got an updated number. What is it?
It's been fairly firm. Actually, I haven't checked today because it's been kind of constant the last week or two. What I'm watching this lawsuit is this. The legislature has already indicated plans to appeal. We know that. But what will it appeal? Remember, there are a number of changes that Conley ordered for the fall election. One, he extended by 1 week the deadline to register via mail or online to vote. I don't think Republicans really are worried about that or care about that. I think they care mostly about the extended deadline for absentee ballots. And now, I'm not a lawyer, but what I want to know is, will the U.S. Supreme Court, which embraced the exact same approach in April, change its mind for November? Because remember, Conley issued a number of changes to the April election, but it was last-minute changes this spring. The appeals court upheld some of them, knocked down one. The Supreme Court stepped in and knocked down another, but upheld the decision saying it's okay as long as they're postmarked by election day in April to receive that following Monday. Will the court go that route again with the November election?
Okay, now, JR, that's important, and I just want to clarify it. I'm trying to understand it. The appeal is now the appeal that the Republicans filed was filed with the same Court of Appeals, which in April said absentee ballots must be counted by 8 p.m. on Election Day. Do I have that right, man?
So the appeals court back in the spring, it was okay with Conley's ruling that extended the deadline until April, I think it was the 13th.
Thank you.
Monday the election.
Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court also embraced that ruling from Connally about the extended deadline. Now, a couple things are different. One, back in April, Connally's ruling said not only would they have to be postmarked by the election day, but received by the Monday after, but clerks couldn't begin counting until the Monday after when the deadline was received, which was 4 o'clock that Monday, I believe. Connally's new ruling does not say anything about preventing local clerks from counting the ballots. So you can still have a count going starting on Tuesday morning, election day, November 3rd, to get those things figured out. And we'll have a rough idea where we're at. If this decision stands, the question would be how many absentee ballots are still out there that could come in and could they tip the election? Now, if everybody gets their ballots in early, not a big deal. But if you have thousands and thousands of ballots that are out there unaccounted for, you know, they haven't been sent back yet after 8 p.m. election day, that could tip the election one way or another in Wisconsin.
But before I quote from Judge Connally's decision, JR, what about the national buzz that one potential result of Connally's order is we don't know when we're going to know who won Wisconsin, which President Trump won with only 22,800 votes out of 2.7 million cast in 2016. What about the idea that we may not know for days who wins Wisconsin?
If it's that close and that, I mean, it bounces out, then absolutely. But let's just talk, throw numbers out there. If it's a spread of 100,000 votes on election night, well, let's say the morning after election, I anticipate the clerks getting through the ballots probably sometime Wednesday morning, all right?
Okay.
If it's a spread of 100,000 votes and there are 20,000 absentee ballots that haven't been sent back yet, that's not going to change the election. But if it's 20,000 votes is the margin and there are 100,000 ballots yet to be sent back, that is a potential game changer. And that's what we just don't know right now, how things are going to look come November 3rd.
Okay.
And I just want to finish up on this topic by quoting from Judge Connally's decision. Election workers and voters' experiences during Wisconsin's primary election in April have convinced the court that some limited relief from statutory deadlines is again necessary to avoid an untenable impingement on Wisconsin citizens' right to vote. But let's say it again, Republican leaders have appealed this decision. Okay, JR.
National GOP can file their own appeals as well. And so just a PS, voters, do not wait because of this decision. If you have your absentee ballot and you want to go to absentee, turn it in sooner than later, because don't rely on this being the law in a month and a half, because we just don't know.
Good advice, JR. Good advice. Okay, I was really struck. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered a bit of a speech and then took questions in our state Senate chamber, which, okay, forget about all the, yeah, the Democrats say it was a campaign rally, and we'll get into that in a minute. But it was just kind of a historical moment. I was struck by it. And how did he get there? A Chinese diplomat asked State Senate President Roger Roth to introduce a resolution praising China's handling of COVID-19. Roth said, no, I don't think so. And that got the attention of Mr. Pompeo, who spoke for, I think, 19 minutes. And he warned that China's communist leaders are intensively trying to influence groups ranging from, and he mentioned Wisconsin sister city partnerships with specific cities, including Richland Center, and holdings by the State Investment Board. Now, this so intrigued me because he called out specific sister city arrangements and our investment board, that let's hear what U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on that subject.
The reality is that most every state legislature in the country has probably received a letter from the CCP, much like Senator Roth's email, as part of a coordinated propaganda campaign. We see it all over in America's sister city programs, like the ones in Door County, La Crosse, Milwaukee, and Richland Center. They fall under the authority of something called the Chinese People's Association of Friendship with Foreign Countries. Sounds benign. But that group is part of China's United Front Work Department, the CCP's official overseas propaganda tool. Look, the federal government can't police every bit of this predatory and coercive behavior. We need your help. And the beauty of our federal system is that we don't have to. You all can take up this mantle. Protecting American interests requires vigilance. Vigilance that starts with you and all state legislators, regardless of party. Know that when you're approached by a Chinese diplomat, it is likely not in the spirit of cooperation or friendship. Know that if you're offered a trip to China when the pandemic travel restrictions are lifted, that you should ask who's paying for the trip and if that person is linked directly or indirectly to the Chinese Communist Party. You can pass laws to codify closer cooperation with federal agencies to assist them in the protection of intellectual property and investment screening and counter-infiltration operations. You can ignore CCP threats and encourage mayors and business people to engage more broadly around the world. And as I told the nation's governors, you can scrutinize your state pension funds. As of its last report, the Wisconsin retirement system has invested in China Mobile and China Telecom. Both are state-owned giants, and they're an integral part of Chinese Orwellian surveillance system. Do you want your teachers, your firefighters, your policemen invested in those kinds of activities?
This morning I did a campaign interview with Congressman Tom Tiffany, whose 7th district includes ginseng growers. And I said, have ginseng growers recovered from the tariffs of the Trump administration? And you can watch his answer in my interview. But here's the point. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, yes, the tariffs from the Trump administration have hurt Wisconsin farmers and businesses. And I think we ought to hear how the Secretary of State justified that hurt, because he explains that we're trying to get an equal playing field with China. So the second part of his speech, taking a question from Senate President Roger Roth, please.
How can we ensure that we're holding China accountable for their abuses in trade and monetary practices, while at the same time making sure that we're keeping our Wisconsin businesses here competitive and afloat?
The first effort was to reach out to the Chinese and say we want to negotiate a fair and equitable and reciprocal trade agreement. So said about it from the beginning. It didn't make a lot of progress. So he began to use America's economic power through the tool of tariffs to impose real costs on Chinese businesses. We have to flip the nature of the relationship. It's imperative. We have to get on an equal footing. And if there are costs in the short run, I am convinced that most Americans are prepared to say, I'll do that. That's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for freedom, democracy. It will ultimately be the right thing to do for their business as well. And so we've tried to ameliorate the harms to small and medium businesses here in the near term for what will be an enormously important strategic shift, which will benefit every American business, from the smallest business in Wisconsin to medium-sized businesses in places like Kansas and Iowa, and to the larger businesses that are operating on a global scale, where they'll have the real opportunity tactically to compete on a fair and level playing field. That's the mission set. That's the purpose of the tariffs. The president's been very clear. He'd love to live in a world, no tariffs, no trade barriers, wide open, let the finest compete. I am confident that Wisconsinites would crush it, given that opportunity. But to get there, there have had to be costs imposed.
Before I get your perspective on this, JR, I just two quotes from State Democratic Senator Tim Carpenter. Republican legislative leaders have refused to convene to debate and pass bills to help Wisconsinites during the COVID-19 pandemic. They haven't even bothered to show up for over 150 days. Today, referring to the appearance by Secretary of State Pompeo, Republicans held a political rally in the state Senate chambers for Donald Trump's reelection. JR, a big win for the Trump campaign to get the Secretary of State to visit our Capitol?
I don't know if it's a win, but it dovetails the theme he's pushed constantly about China being a threat to the United States. Also, you've seen Pompeo take a much more high-profile role in the race than you typically see from the Secretary of State. Don't forget, during the National Republican Convention, Pompeo gave a speech from overseas, which was unusual, to say the least, for a sitting Secretary of State. It's just part of the theme from the Trump campaign, of a Trump world, of this is a threat to us, and it's part of also one of their main themes against Governor Joe Biden, that he'd be weak on China.
Okay. Jared, this next topic is something you're much more into than I am, so I'm really interested in your perspective. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson said this week he believes that the U.S. Senate should vote to confirm whoever the president announces tomorrow as the Supreme Court replacement for the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Let me just quote Senator Johnson, excuse me. President Trump was elected for a term that runs into January. Republicans have control of the Senate until the end of this Congress. We should fulfill that constitutional duty. But, J.R., I tried to look up what Senator Johnson said in 2016, and the term you use in one of your reports is, when President Obama forwarded the name of Merrick Garland to the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate, Senator Johnson called that problematic. Okay, your turn. Fill in the blanks on what the back and forth here.
Consistency isn't the strong point of politicians. I mean, that's the bottom line. And let's not also forget that Tammy Baldwin 4 years ago called for hearings, a floor vote, and a confirmation of Merrick Garland. Now she's saying we should wait till the next Senate is seated to pick a next U.S. Supreme Court justice. Look, but Baldwin is using the standard that she says was set by Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, 4 years ago to change her position. Johnson is trying to say, well, the situation has changed because the party in power in the White House, the same party in power in the Senate, that's different than 4 years ago. Now, 4 years ago, Ron Johnson didn't mention party in this. He said any nomination election was problematic. In fact, he said that he thought you should avoid nomination election year, period, because it was too political, it was unfair both to the justice being, or the nominee and to the court. Things have changed. Look, politics is about two things only, right, Steve? Getting power and keeping power.
Yes.
And once you have that power, you exercise it. Republicans are exercising the power that they have, regardless of how it offends anybody else, because they see a chance to change this court's balance, perhaps for a generation. They're not going to pass that up, not when you have issues like Roe v. Wade that could be overturned with a new composition of the court. They're not going to miss this opportunity, and Democrats are going to howl about it. The only question I have is, when will the vote be? Will it be before the election? Will it be after the election? The president's kind of expressed his preference. I might hear with Johnson on Saturday this past week. He said even if you had a situation where the president lost in November and the Senate flipped to Democratic control, he would be okay with a vote in a lame duck session because, again, their terms run through January. So there's nothing I can see right now holding Republicans back from taking a vote, regardless if it's before or after the election.
U.S. Senate Republicans have 53 seats. Now, you and I, because we're political junkies, have been watching the statements from Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who says, I'm uncomfortable voting for whoever President Trump names. Susan Collins said the same thing. 53 subtract 2, that's 51. Everybody looked to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, who voted on one article of impeachment, said, I'm inclined to vote to confirm. So it looks like Ron Johnson is lining up with what seems to be a majority that will confirm whoever Trump announces. But JR, you make a good point, before or after November 3. Finally, JR, statement of, I'm going to call it hyperbole, from the state Democratic chairman: if Ron Johnson shatters the trust of his constituents by voting for a nominee before the next Senate is seated, he will cement his legacy as a disgrace to Wisconsin and demonstrate to voters that he is unworthy of public office. That's from the state Democratic chair. How much damage to Mr. Johnson, who may or may not seek re-election in 2022?
Well, there are other issues that for Senator Johnson to consider for 2022. I don't know if this is the issue that's going to define him in 2 years. The question that I have really is, how does this impact the 2020 presidential race? Because remember, 4 years ago, Mitch McConnell made a very good one, that by holding off on the Obama nomination, well, blocking the Obama nomination, that he could motivate conservatives who were uncomfortable with Donald Trump to turn out and vote in droves that fall because of the Supreme Court seat, to prevent that court flipping to a majority liberal control, essentially. Now, the question is, do they vote on it before the election to send a message of, we delivered? And does that excite the conservative base, or do they hold off on it until after the election as a carrot? The conservative base, hey, you need to turn out for us still. Because I've read opinions both ways about whether if you vote on it before the election, it kind of diminishes the impact for Republicans, whereas it would jazz up Democrats because they'd be outraged. I'm not smart enough to know what the best approach is, but there's a calculation for either timing of the vote on how it might impact November.
Yeah. Okay. New topic. After we taped the last Rewind, I was surprised to get the a statement from the governor that he had requested and received the resignation of Caleb Frostman, the secretary of the Department of Workforce Development. The governor said, people across our state are struggling to make ends meet, and it is unacceptable that Wisconsinites continue to wait for the support. That means their unemployment, jobless benefits, our maximum is $370 a week. They need during these challenging times. This week, DWD reported that 10% of claims filed since March 15th were pending or, quote, still in progress. The governor blamed outdated technology. Republicans, you've never updated it. And also, Republican changes that, in the governor's words, made it, quote, harder for jobless claimants to receive that. The governor named a deputy secretary of corrections, and Senator Capping, a Republican, been critical of Mr. Frostman, said, "This leaves another stain directly on Governor Evers' ability to choose qualified leaders. I hope for the sake of the nearly 100,000 people who haven't received their unemployment checks that the new secretary designee fixes this disaster quickly." JR, I was surprised because the governor had backed Secretary Frostman for 2 months, 2.5 months. Why Friday? Why a week ago?
Well, what happened today? There was an audit released today that showed roughly 1% or so of the calls to the call center between March and June got through. Okay. There are problems there. And from what I was told, those problems built the point that the governor's frustrated without seeing progress. Because don't forget, in late May, Caleb Frostman testified to a Senate committee that they would have the backlog resolved by October. Well, October is only a few days away. In late May, 11.2%, I believe, of weekly claims had not been processed. As of last week, before he was basically fired, it was 10.9%. There's not been a significant improvement on that adjudication process, even though the number of bodies over there basically tripled. So when I asked people, the feedback I got was that Frostman failed to show the proper kind of urgency. Now, there is a issue for the governor and his office as well about how quickly it acted to anticipate this issue. Maybe they should have put more resources there early on versus what its priorities were with COVID-19. That said, this is going to be a problem for Governor Evers if he seeks re-election 2022. You have a failure here, his administration, to handle a basic function of government, which is to process claims for people who need the money to survive in a very difficult environment. The question is, how problematic is it going to be? And two, with the interim secretary, what does she bring to the table? Urgency, I was told, is possibly one thing that she'd come in and kind of figure out what's going on and try and fix it quicker. But there needs to be something just besides a changing of the leader to fix this problem, because you've got the bodies there. Why isn't the backlog going down and going down quickly?
Okay. We got so much news, we're going to go into overtime, but it's worth it. We're beginning a new feature on this week's Rewind. Through the election, we're calling it Battleground Wisconsin. Without comment, we're going to give you statements and speeches from, we're calling it Battleground Wisconsin, voices from the campaign trail. Unedited, we're just going to give you what Democratic nominee Joe Biden said in Manitowoc on Monday, and what Vice President Mike Pence said in Eau Claire yesterday, and then we'll go right into stock picks. Please.
I've been living with this pandemic for so long, I worry we're risking becoming numb to the toll that is taken on us and our country and communities like this. We can't let that happen. Trump was worried that if he told the public the truth, there would be a panic on the financial markets, and that would hurt his chances of being reelected. That's how Donald Trump views the world. He sees the world from Park Avenue. I see it from where I grew up, in a town like this, from Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hard scrapple, hard working town, just like this and so many more across Wisconsin. The simple truth is that Donald Trump ran for office saying he would represent the forgotten men and women in this country. And then once he got in office, he forgot us. Frankly, I've dealt with guys like Trump my whole life. Guys from the neighborhood I come from who look down on us because we didn't have a lot of money, their parents didn't go to college. Guys who think they're better than you. Guys who inherit everything they've ever gotten in their life and squander it. Guys who stretch and squeeze and stiff electricians and plumbers and contractors working on their hotels and casinos and golf courses just to put a few more bucks in their pocket. I want to spend just a few moments talking about those who voted for Donald Trump last time. When I was out here in our administration, you voted for us, and then an awful lot of people in this county changed and they voted for Trump last time. I know many of you were frustrated. You're angry. You believe we weren't seen. You weren't being seen, represented, or heard. I get it. It has to change, and I promise you this. It will change with me. You will be seen, heard, and respected by me. This campaign isn't about just winning votes. It's about restoring the basic dignity in this country that every worker deserves. Basic dignity that we all have. Without winning back the hearts and, yes, the soul of America, we're not going to make it.
So we rebuilt our military. We revived our economy. We stood for life, our liberties, and law and order in those first 3 years. We made America great again. Then the coronavirus struck from China. But I'm here to tell you, before the first documented case of community transmission within the United States, President Trump did what no American president had ever done before. He suspended all travel from China, the second largest economy in the world. President Trump's action saved untold American lives, and it bought us invaluable time to stand up the largest national mobilization since World War II. And as we speak, we're developing medicines that are saving lives every day, and we are on track to have the first safe and effective coronavirus vaccine before the end of this year. That's record time, Wisconsin. This president, in the midst of these challenging times, always had American families and businesses just like this one on his heart. That's why our president worked with leaders in both parties in the Congress. We secured more than $4 trillion in direct aid for American families and American businesses. The experts tell us that the paycheck protection alone kept workers on the payroll at 89,000 Wisconsin businesses and saved 50 million American jobs from being lost. When it comes to standing strong on the world stage, President Donald Trump will always put Wisconsin farmers, Wisconsin manufacturing, and Wisconsin families first.
So that's our new Rewind feature through the election, Battleground Wisconsin, Voices from Campaign Trail. And the segue is to your stock picks, JR.
All right, rising Dem spending. The state Democratic Party outspent the Republican Party in the last reporting period, 5 weeks, 16 to 1. A lot of that money went to candidates. Why is important is because the largesse the party's been able to pull together from its fundraising is now helping candidates in these key legislative races with direct transfers. I mean, we're talking, I think, $1.9 million in a five-week period just to candidates. That's a lot of money.
Next.
Yeah, UW System. This week, the Department administration announced it's now targeting $301 million lapses from state agencies for the second year of the budget. Even though it went up $50 million from the previous target, UW System share went down. The system told us that originally they thought they were going to get a $69 million cut. Now it's under $45 million, so that's less of a haircut. Don't forget, though, in the first round, in the last fiscal year, they also had $45 million. It's still a $90 million cut to UW. Also, it's a maybe not a great sign for the next budget, depending on how badly that thing, or how good or bad that thing looks.
Falling.
Student voters, a federal judge this week punted after the election, a case on whether a challenge to a requirement of Wisconsin law that student IDs must have an expiration date to be a valid photo ID. The judge basically said, look, it's too close to the election to do this. It could cause confusion. Oh, by the way, there are about a half dozen campuses or so that don't qualify right now. And there's plenty of time for students who want one to go get a valid ID from the state.
So much news. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for September 25.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.